Good morning. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and also elders of more recent arrivals. I'd like to welcome our listeners tuned in not just in Brisbane but across the country through the National Indigenous Radio Service and through the internet if you're listening to our website or podcast. I'm talking about a sad situation today, but I hope it's one that you might have heard of before. On August 4th last year, a Yamatji woman, her name was Jalika Du, died in a South Hedland watch house in Western Australia. She was only 22. She had committed no crime. In fact, she was in jail to pay off about $1,000 in parking fines. She was refused hospital care twice while in horrendous pain. In fact, an Aboriginal man in a nearby cell told the media that he heard Ms. Du vomiting day and night and crying out. She died after being transported for the third time to the Hedland Health Campus. It's been a year and the family still don't know the cause of her death, have not seen the medical report and are still waiting for an inquest. In fact, next Tuesday is the 1 year anniversary of Jalika's death. But how many of you know her name? It's because of the tenacity and strength of her family, some of whom have flown across the country to rally support, that her case is known at all. But she's not the only one to remain almost nameless in the public consciousness. In 2012, a 44-year-old Aboriginal artist, Maureen Mundijara, was arrested for public drunkenness and was found deceased in a Broome prison cell a day later, another black death in custody. More than 2 years on, there has been no coronial inquiry. The reason, according to the WA government, is because the WA police had yet to hand in the investigation report to the coroner. Now, Jalika Du's family, in contrast, will only have to wait until November this year for the coronial inquest. But even that seems so long to wait. On Tuesday, they're holding a National Day of Action to mark the first anniversary of her death. I'm marking it a bit early. And earlier this week, I spoke to her uncle, Sean Harris. You're Jalika's uncle. How would you describe her? And what are your favourite memories of her?
Yeah, she was always happy and smiling. You know, she was loved by everyone in the family, like all the family and friends. Well, she was one of those people that would be very hard to find an enemy, you know, someone that didn't like her. She was like a mother to all her little nieces and nephews as well, you know, and her little sisters and things like that as well. And it's just a shock to us all still that she's still not here.
August 4th last year was a sad day for Sean. It didn't just mark the day that Jalika died, but also was the anniversary of his young son's death. The effect her death has had on her family has been incredibly traumatic, as he explains.
Well, actually, I was on my way back from Perth to Geraldton that day. It was the 10th anniversary of my son's passing, and then I found out about a quarter of an hour after I got into Geraldton about Jalika's passing. So that was pretty heavy and pretty deep shock for myself.
And that was on August 4th?
Yes. So that's almost 1 week away to a year on. As we speak.
Did you know that Jalika had been incarcerated prior to that?
No, I didn't know myself personally, but Auntie Carol and some of the family knew, but they tried to contact the South Hedland Watch House and whatnot. Didn't take long. We started, you know, getting pieces of information here and there from family up there, plus other contacts here and there as well, so...
Do you remember what the first details you received that day when you heard that she'd passed away?
Well, it was pretty much... I couldn't go around to see the family because I was actually at the cemetery visiting my son's grave for his anniversary, and when we found out about Jalika's passing. And Auntie Carol's house is only just... Well, you can see it from the cemetery, so we could see all the people that was, you know, turning up to show respects and things like that, so... I was too hurt and shocked and stuff, so I couldn't see the family at the time.
Wow.
For a while, you know, that's the Whited family, and Auntie Carol, well, she knew her because of my son's passing and the same anniversary. So, you know, that's why it's extra personal for myself as well. You know, now I'm going to have to have those memories, same anniversary memories of my niece and my own son passing on the same day for the rest of my life as well, you know, which is...
Yeah, August 4th must be etched in your memory, and 1 year on, it feels like a longer time than 1 year, doesn't it, since she's passed?
Yeah, well, it sure does. Well, I've travelled so many caves, and we've travelled, you know, we've done so much of our campaign, the family and friends and campaign and supporters, you know, to bring this to light and to help spread awareness and to try and raise some support up as much as we could to keep highlighting this issue.
Just before you mentioned Auntie Carol, she's Jalika's grandmother, and she actually rang up the Watch House a few times when Jalika was incarcerated, and she wasn't told anything, was she?
Well, yes, that's right. Not very much at all, if anything. And here we are. We've got a coronial inquest starting on 23rd of November. We still haven't even got medical records, which is the family's legal rights to have, and 1 year on.
You don't know.
You
don't know how Jalika died. You don't know what health problems she had when she went into the Watch House, even now?
Well, she was untreated infection, apparently, though there are a lot of different things that led to her death as well, due to errors.
Leading up to
the
death.
Mistakes, et cetera, leading up to... Yeah, the time of her passing, which was in the police watch house from, you know, where the police lied and the government lied from the start and said that it wasn't, it didn't happen there. Yeah.
It's been a year. Have you been able to piece together sort of a timeline of what happened to Jalika before she went to the watch house, before she was jailed, and then throughout, and when she was taken to the health campus and sent back?
Yeah, we have some sort of pretty good timeline, reliable, although that's why we want these things in the inquest to hurry up, because we want to know the truth of what's happened. And we won't know the truth until the inquest is over, and, well, hopefully most of the truth will come out, or, you know, as much as possibly can. Considering how the government is.
I think one of the biggest questions is why should she have been jailed in the first place for parking fines? Do you think she should have ever been in that situation at all?
No, well, that's just ridiculous, because myself being a black person in Western Australia, or in Australia for that matter, just know of so many friends and family members that are in the jails just because of unpaid fines. You know, unpaid fines, jailing in exchange for paying off unpaid fines is just stupid.
You yourself have fines, don't you? And you wouldn't go to jail to pay them off because you've never been to jail.
No, well, that's right. And I don't intend to ever go to jail, but especially for it not to be over petty unpaid fines. You know, a lot of people over east that I've travelled and met, and they're in awe and shock that we're still getting locked up over here, be it in the jails or the watch houses, because of unpaid fines. That's why the prison systems over here are massively overcrowded and overrepresented by black people.
I can see why people would prefer to just go to jail and clear them, because $250 a day, you can clear those fines. If you don't have a lot of money, is it easier to go to jail, to put yourself in that situation?
Well, sadly, a lot of black fellas are too used to jail, so they'd rather go to jail, just cut out and be clean, and they clean, so to speak, and have no fines when they get out. But it's a personal choice, you know, and a lot of people are paying off fines through getting money taken out of their family payments fortnightly or weekly.
And how long would it take a person if they have, just say like Jalika, a $1,000 fine, $1,000 in parking fines, how would it take, how long would it take to do it through Centrelink?
Well, it can be negotiable, the amount of money they can take to get taken out, but then sometimes it cannot be. So sometimes it could be between 20 or 50 or 60 or 100 bucks a fortnight even.
Wow.
You know, and if you only get $400 a fortnight paid when you're a mother, even, you know, or even just a single person.
How would you describe the police in Port Hedland and Geraldton, I guess?
Well, they can be very non-cooperative and funny towards, you know, they get bored a lot. So what they do when they get bored, they'll drive around and just, you know, even black kids walking down the street on the weekend. Doesn't have to be midweek, you know, even on the weekends, they'll pull up and ask and get their names and things, you know, just because they walk along.
Yeah.
I'm 38 years old, and since I was young, a kid, we always was afraid of the police.
Yeah.
You know, never done nothing wrong. It's just how all black fellas are who grow up.
Yeah, yeah. You're made to feel like a criminal just because of the colour of your skin, really.
Well, yeah, that's right. You know, my parents used to tell us, you know, uncles and aunties driving, you know, when we're in the back, we've got our seatbelts on, they're still telling us to get your seatbelts on. Don't turn around and look at them, you know, they'll turn around and, you know, oh, things like that. It's just, and with death in custody, yeah, they keep treating us and killing us. It doesn't help.
Do you think it's gotten worse over the fruit through your lifetime? Now that you're 38, can you see it has gradually gotten worse, or do you think it's gotten a little bit better?
I'd like to say it has gotten better, but I can't sort of really say it's gotten worse either from what I've experienced, because I've grown up in a small country town and we do get along, the community, with their sports. You know, we grew up playing footy and going to school together, basketball, you know. So the police, we usually do have good relationships and country towns there, but for every one cop, good cop, you know, that's just a drop in the ocean compared to the amount of not so very good cops that are out there.
Yep. And you have, when you were 11, you remember another death in custody in Geraldton, don't you? Can you tell me a little bit about that and how few things have changed since that original death in custody that you remember?
Yeah, that was... I marched down the street in 1988 for a friend of a family. His name was Edward Cameron. He was a death in custody in the Geraldton lockup. And long story short, as well, sort of, was he that night ended up in being the Geraldton riot, where the whole of the Geraldton, main street of Geraldton, got pretty much messed up, every window in the street, because Geraldton just had enough of that treatment and death in custody in Geraldton. Geraldton, they do know about death in custody, that's why they actually tried to hold back on us last year with the proceedings and organising for the Geraldton protest, you know. Just, they didn't want to really support it straight away. And so we had to have a meeting in the police station with them.
Is that because there was a perception there'd be a riot instead of just a protest? Is that why they wanted to meet with you?
Well, yeah, we had to meet with them. We had to have two Perth delegates come up from the Death in Custody Watch Committee and an Aboriginal advocate came up from Perth to Geraldton, met with myself and quite a few family members, including Carol, Jalika's grandmother. Then we went to the police station and had a meeting with, I think it was the inspector for the Midwest region, about the protest. I was making excuses about safety and the streets narrowing out and it's not safe and this and that, but we always protest down the same streets. And so, you know, just things little petty things that they tried to make excuses and hold back. So we ended up getting that done anyway.
Can you tell me a bit about the protests that are going to happen next Tuesday around Australia and where they're going to be and what you're hoping will in a way be achieved or be put on the table?
Yeah, well, we've got the main protest will be in Geraldton because that was Talika's home, but I've just found out that South Island are now doing one as well, which we're all happy to hear about. But we've got South Island, Geraldton, Perth is doing a solidarity action as well as Canberra. And Melbourne and Sydney as well.
Are there details or a website where people can go to see where they can mobilise if there's a protest in their city?
Yeah, well, there's actually a few events up on Facebook. Should be a, sorry, one off the top of my head, there's a Geraldton event at the moment. There's a Canberra, Melbourne and Sydney Facebook event. So there's 1, 2, 5. And the Perth one actually as well. So there's 5 Facebook events going at the moment for the Perth, for the first anniversary protest. And yeah, there's things that we need to be addressing, you know, just off the top of my head now is the 11 campaign demands from last year, the custody notification service, the treatment of police in the cell at the lockup, and you know, in transit at the health campus, the treatment by the people at the health campus. You know, why haven't we still got medical records? It's a year on almost. The coroner inquest is starting in only a matter of months and we still haven't got medical records. So, you know, that's unbelievable in itself.
Yeah, definitely.
The police actually burnt Jaleesa's clothes as well. And, yeah, going to start implementing the recommendations, Colin Barnett, because he publicly promised and if he wants to start stopping and helping to, you know, to prevent death in custody, it's plain and simple.
Yep.
You can't even remove hanging points.
Wow. Those are still in there.
That's one of the recommendations, pretty much, you know, as far as remove hanging points. They can't even do that in every lockup in Australia.
Yep.
It doesn't take much to remove a hanging point with a grinder and cover it over, you know, at the least.
What would, because the coronial inquest is coming up in November. And you've, a lot of the time when coronial inquests happen, it hardly ever leads to criminal convictions or any charges or any further legal action. I mean, what would justice look like for you and Jaleesa's family, do you think?
We just want truth and justice and closure and accountability. Main thing being, well, not the main thing, but accountability with emphasis, meaning true accountability with true convictions. That's what accountability is, and that in itself may stop the police with their severe maltreatment and deprivation of liberty, which they always inflict the great majority of times on all black people who are locked up.
What's the wait been like for your family? How does it feel waiting for over a year for that coronial inquest?
It's been very long, but still quite happy that it's come through. Under 2 years will be by the time November comes along. No, that would not have happened, we feel, if we didn't, as a campaign and the public, if we didn't all stand up and try and, you know, keep this in the spotlight.
Yeah, that's very true. I don't think it would have happened either. I think it's been the tenacity and the strength of your family that's the reason why a lot of people know Jaleesa's name now and that they've been forced to. I mean, you got the premier up to South Hedland, so I think that really shows.
Yeah, that was sort of a small win sort of thing for us all. The inquest is going to be pretty hard to go through, but we're all happy that it's finding something concrete.
Yeah.
You know, a matter of what's going to come out of it and how soon after that.
That was the uncle of Jaleesa Jew, a 22-year-old Yamaji woman who died in custody in Port Hedland last year, actually August 4th, and the family are organising a national day of action to be held around the country with protests in Port Hedland and Geraldton and Perth, Melbourne, Sydney, unfortunately not Brisbane, but if you want more details of that, we'll put it up on the website. Amanda Porter is a woman from the University of Technology, Sydney. Her research interests are around justice issues, but she's predominantly interested in deaths in custody, and she's written a bit on Jalika Jew and also about media comparisons between the way Australian media report death in custody is compared to the American media, for example. I spoke to her about Jalika's case and also past cases of deaths in custody. Talking today about marking the first year anniversary of Jalika Jew, a young Yemaji woman who died in custody in Port Hedland on August 4th last year. There's been a number of deaths in custody in the decades following the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. Why are the numbers still so high? Why do we still have to talk about this?
Well, it's they're still high because, you know, government departments are still implementing policies that are inconsistent with the recommendations of the Royal Commission. And what saddens me in particular as a researcher, having read the Royal Commission, the five different volumes and the 99 reports, if you look at of those 99 individual reports, there of those that are women, a lot of them bear so many parallels with Jalika Jew's case, and these are reports that were written in the 1980s, and that's just that just adds a whole other dimension of tragedy, and I think responsibility on the part of government departments that are putting in place these laws that I think when you talk about why it is that Indigenous people are overrepresented for these petty fines, and why Indigenous women in particular are overrepresented for these fines, is because we're looking at systemic racism, systemic sexism, and just systems of disadvantage that are just coming together. And if what I can't understand is that, you know, you can read research and articles written from the 1980s saying that it makes no sense to lock up people for fines, for unpaid fines, that this is just incarcerating the poor. This isn't incarcerating criminals, and that it just makes no sense and ought to be changed. And, you know, how can you read this 35 years later and make any sense of this?
That's very true. And looking at Aboriginal women specifically, we never hear about Aboriginal women, the Aboriginal women who've died in custody. When you talk about the similarities between those cases and Jalika Jew, why are Aboriginal women being incarcerated? And is this the safest place for them to be in a prison cell?
No, it's not a safe space, and it's also not a humane space. I mean, it's already, I can't imagine the horror and the trauma for a family finding out that a member of their family has passed away, let alone that they've done so in such degrading and inhumane, you know, spaces, like on a cold cement floor in a police cell. Like, how horrifying.
Looking specifically at Jalika Jew, it's been a year since she passed away. The families are still waiting for a coronial inquiry. How does this affect families, the long wait for answers, knowing that potentially there could never be any justice?
Yeah, and sadly, they're not the only ones. It's a similar case. There was another Aboriginal woman who passed away in the Northern Territory. Again, it's been 18 months. I don't believe I've seen the coronial inquiry report yet. It's just such a long wait, and it's just such an unsatisfactory system for victims in particular. And even, you know, best case scenario that there is an outcome on with the inquiry, there is just limited redress for victims and for families after a death in custody. So even if you have a case, as say in Palm Island, when a coroner, Coroner Clements, I believe, stated in the conclusion of that coronial inquest that the senior Sergeant Hurley in that case did cause the death. And I'm just citing verbatim from the report. She found that the actions of the police officer caused the death. Even in a case like that, where there's clear causation attributed to a police officer, even in that case, Hurley wasn't convicted. It was so hard to prosecute him in the first place to charge him in the first place. And even before the court system, a Townsville jury found that he wasn't guilty, even not even of murder, but of assault. So to me, it just leaves the conclusion that there is no justice for Aboriginal people under the criminal justice system, that what we have in Australia is not a system of law that prides itself on equality, but we have three systems of law. We have we have white justice, we have black justice, and we have blue justice. Depending on where you sit, the law will deliver a different outcome. And I think you only need to look at any example to see that. So to look at, Sergeant Hurley's failure to be found guilty under very, very small charges of assault. Again, he was never charged for murder. He was charged for manslaughter and assault, but still came out not guilty. And then look, more recent examples. Look at the Northern Territory. You've got recently there was a case where a white man was, given a $2,000 fine and 6 months home detention for a fatal hit and run.
Very true.
So.
And there's accountability, is there, Amanda?
No, there's no accountability and there's no police oversight. And it just leads the conclusion to me that there are three systems of justice here.
That's very true. The fact that no police officer has ever been convicted over death in custody, even when you look at cases like Mr. Ward, where it was security guards and they'd fundamentally failed their duty of care, the family of Jaleka Dewey, even when the coronial inquest occurs, what avenues are often open to families of death in custody victims? Are they just supposed to go away and just try and mourn and try and heal? Are there ever any other avenues in your view?
Well, for me, it just goes back to, in terms of legal avenues, there's very limited redress for families and for victims. There's, as I said, there's never been a police officer that's been successfully convicted for a death in custody case. There's been what we call civil trials, so for negligence. And I think, looking at Mr. Ward's case, for me, as I see the facts, this is a clear example of negligence at a government departmental level, the way he was treated and the lack of duty of care displayed for him and his well-being. And I'd say the same in for Jaleka Dewey, that this is just really bad policy and lack of duty of care. It is, I see it as criminal, I see it as negligence, I see it as all of these things, but the legal system won't recognise that, and there really is really limited redress within the conventional legal system.
Premier Colin Barnett has made a couple of public commitments to the family of Jaleka Dewey, namely that he was going to do an internal review into deaths in custody. But his comments and his commitments, when you consider them, when you put them up against his other policies, for example, toughening mandatory sentencing in WA and sort of kowtowing to the public's law and order wish, is it just show that it's a bit of lip service from his government?
Yeah, it shows like there's clear internal inconsistency here. I mean, Western Australia has the worst reputation in the nation for incarcerating Aboriginal people, for incarcerating Aboriginal women, for incarcerating Aboriginal young people. You know, any way you look for it, look at the statistics for young people, young Aboriginal people in detention. 78.3% of the latest statistics in Western Australian prison system, and yet Barnett is saying, oh, yes, I will look into this and I'm sorry for your loss, I believe he said. And in the meantime, is passing the criminal law home burglary bill, which introduces the three strikes and you're out, mandatory detention, as you say, for home burglary. So it's just really rhetoric that is not consistent with the policies that he's implementing. And then in the meantime, you've got Michael Mishen, the Attorney General, who says that, who justifies three strikes and you're out laws, and so you have this really real inconsistency and contradiction, coupled with, you know, really, really meaningless rhetoric. Even, on the other hand,
very true. And even continuing a policy, and even the numbers are increasing, of locking up people, and particularly Aboriginal people, for non-payment of fines. The numbers have jumped over the past few years, haven't they? And WA is the only state that does this still.
Yeah, the numbers have increased. The numbers have increased since the Royal Commission, and it's something that I struggle to understand as a researcher, because there are clear. There's been the major Royal Commission. There's been 339 clear recommendations on how to avoid Aboriginal deaths in custody. And I'd go as far as saying that any other Royal Commission that's been conducted in Australia would not be met with this kind of negligent response. So, you know, it's unthinkable for me, you know, thinking about the current Royal Commission, say, on sexual abuse, that fast forward 20 years, that the recommendations that were made weren't taken seriously by government departments. And I just, you know, I just see this as negligence, and I see this as a lack of caring and a lack of humanity, you know, something that all Australians ought to be thinking about.
It's interesting you mentioned briefly what happens overseas. In America, there's been a lot of talk around the case of Sandra Bland, who was a 28-year-old African-American woman who was arrested on a traffic violation and 3 days later was found dead in her cell. Now, that death in custody has caused a huge amount of public debate and media attention in America. And yet Jalika Joo was arrested for non-payment of parking fines, and yet a lot of people still wouldn't know her name. What does it say about Australia as a country?
That's a great question, Amy. And the parallels between the Sandra Bland case and Jalika Joo are many. The main difference, I think, is that I've read newspaper articles about Sandra Bland in Australia, and I think, you know, in contrast, you know, in terms of the way these issues are reported within the mainstream media, it's fair to say that, firstly, these issues aren't reported, they're underreported. I mean, I mentioned earlier the death of a respected Aboriginal man in Northern Territory who passed away while in custody under the paperless arrest scheme. How many newspaper articles were there published about his death? There was no frontline article. There was, I counted, one article, one comment in the Sydney Morning Herald, written by the Eddie Kubilo, the NATSL's executive officer. So, you know, one article. How many of, you know, it seems that the Australian media, as far as I'm concerned, the Australian mainstream media, care more about deaths in custody that occur overseas than they do about those that occur in their own backyards. And in terms of why, I don't know. I think part of it is that the media is essentially a corporate body. It's, you know, they're interested in newsworthy events and, you know, articles that make its white readers feel guilty aren't going to sell papers.
And it's,
that's the only way I can understand it, Amy.
Yeah, even the way Sandra Bland has been reported in America, I can't imagine it happening in a similar way in Australia, because they actually are talking about power of police and the concentration of power. They're talking about the fact that she may not have, it may not have been a suicide. They're not immediately taking the police's, the sheriff's word, which is what happens in Australia. We immediately take the police will come out and say, oh no, we're doing an investigation, but he's cleared, he was forced to do it. That's not happening in America, and it's that difference in the way that we accept the truth. We accept it from authority figures and not from we don't actually investigate it enough.
Exactly, and that's well, that's a reflection, firstly, of the fact, I think, that the police have a very strong public relations arm, where they write press releases, and these are often, you know, taken without questioning, and just because it's easier and because of lazy journalism for a variety of reasons, these are just taken for granted and re-reported in the mainstream media, and all of a sudden you have Australians reading in the paper and accepting these facts for a given, when these facts are disputed, when they're just one version of events. And then But that only goes so far, I think. I think another part of that equation is that in America, people talk about race, and that discussion about race relations, as you said in your article yesterday, Amy, just doesn't happen in Australia. When there's a death in custody, you will never hear the word racial profiling. You'll never hear the word police brutality. And part of my own research on deaths in custody is looking at the way the media talk about these events, how they frame these events, the words they use, the terminology they use, and what I think is striking is, first of all, in terms of the language they use, that let's just take an example. So when Morangi Dumaji passed away, he was referred to, we didn't hear about him as a human being. So that's one clear contrast. If you look at the media reporting on Sandra Bland, on Michael Brown, it's really people talk about Michael Brown as a brother, as a young student, as a basketball player, as a lover of sports. We hear about him as a human. When a death in custody is reported in Australia, you won't hear about Julie Ikadu being a beautiful young woman, which she was. You won't hear about her being a beautiful granddaughter. It'll be reported all these elements that make it humane. I think that these deaths in custody, these individuals are really robbed of their humanity by the mainstream press. And in the case of Dumaji, he was referred to as an Aborigine, as a drunken Aborigine. We don't really hear anything more about the victim. Yeah. And then conversely, if you look at the perpetrator of the violence, they're referred to in a way that underlines their authority and is quite positive. So it was never Hurley, about it. He was always referred to as Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley.
Very true.
Which automatically, changes. These elements are really important in this kind of, narrative that's created, the storytelling of the event. And then this really changes the way an audience might come to read what happened.
And it's really interesting you mentioned the case on Palm Island as well, because when they staged the uprising, and that was out of a sheer sense of frustration that nothing was being done, they were immediately condemned by sections of the media, even though this is probably
Absolutely.
One of the biggest travesties that has happened in Queensland by far in recent history. They were characterised as deviants, as almost like criminals, weren't they, those who rose up in protest.
Yep. And again, if just looking at the, I did an analysis of the terminology used in the mainstream media accounts and in Ferguson and in Palm Island. And I think, the results of that study I find just fascinating but also mind-boggling. So, if you look at any of the resistance that occurred in Palm Island or in Redfern, the kind of words that you'll see are kind of, really, really overwhelmingly negative. So riots, mainly the word, the R word, the riot word, looting, the word dangerous, criminal. In contrast, there's just such a variety of terms that are used to explain protests that are occurring in Ferguson or that are occurring in Baltimore or in the United States. So the terms that the Australian press might talk about, might use to refer to those events, will be framed in terms of protest, in terms of resistance, in terms of die-ins, in terms of righteous individuals. But all of these issues go to framing an event.
Mm. That's very true. And I'm interested in Palm Island ended up being a national story that everyone talked about after the uprising. Jalikadu, not so much. The family have really had to push and organise their own protests. Why does it take what the white media would call a riot to make Australia take notice?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Sam Watson said in relation to the G20, you know, why is it that, you know, then just to give some context for people that missed it, at the G20 there were protests about the death of Julie Ikeadu, and I understand that six Australian flags were burnt, and Sam Watson said, why is it that, you know, six, you know, there's a death in custody, four deaths in custody, and none of them will ever reach the number one. None of them will be a headline. None of them, you know, they may not even feature within the spectre of the Australian media. But then, you know, some flag burning, number one, number one on the Sydney Morning Herald and the Daily Telegraph. So all of a sudden you have an event that's newsworthy. You know, why is that? I think it's a sad indictment of the Australian mainstream press, and it's also, you know, and part of that might be, you know, that it, you know, flag burning sells more papers, but there, I believe that there is a responsibility of the mainstream press to report and to conduct investigative journalism on important social justice issues.
That's very true. I mean, it was a lot of the journalism around cases like John Pat, like Eddie Murray and like Lloyd Boney that led to the Royal Commission in the first place. Do you see a time when we'll have journalism like that again, where sort of white mainstream media will be effectively on the Aboriginal side in this matter, and that it could actually lead to change?
I think a lot needs to be done, but a lot, you know, I believe that the Australian mainstream media do have a responsibility in this area. I believe also that everyday Australians have the responsibility to educate themselves and to diversify the kind of media that they're listening to seek out alternative media outlets to read widely. But I think the mainstream media really has a long way to go in terms of improving the way it reports on Indigenous issues, the way it reports on Indigenous justice issues in particular, and to do something to begin to educate white Australia about these very important social issues.
Colin Barnett has often said when he talks about Julie Ikeadu is that Aboriginal deaths in custodies have actually fallen in relation to non-Indigenous custodies. So there's per proportion more non-Indigenous custodies every year. I mean, what do you think when you hear statistics like that sort of downplay the significance of black deaths in custody?
I'd ask Colin Barnett, and you know, I'll happily tweet this to him later, where are you getting these statistics from? I'm a criminologist. I read reports from the Australian Institute of Criminology. Western Australia has the worst reputation in Australia. You know, the current statistics that I have here in front of me was the one I stated to you earlier, the most current statistic, 78.3% of young people in juvenile detention centres in Western Australia are Aboriginal. So, and that rate has been rising consistently for the last 15 years. So I would dispute the statistics that he's using, and I see it more just as a statistics, something that he is using here just to back up his fairly superficial claim. Yep. that he is sorry for Julie, he is sorry for your losses, he said, and that he is trying to do something while in the meantime trying to rush through acts such as the Home Detention Act, which will, one, are totally contradictory with the recommendations of the Royal Commission, and that we all know are just going to be increasing that number.
Are very vulnerable people too, with health
absolutely
problems.
Yeah. It's an inhumane bill. I don't know why he's passing it. I would encourage any listener out there who feels this issue is important to go onto the Amnesty International website and to sign the petition. There is a draft email that you can send to Michael Mishan, the Attorney General of Western Australia, encouraging them to stop the passing of that bill. It's a really important campaign. I can't understand what motivates these actors to pass laws that they know will be increasing numbers of Indigenous people in prison for really petty offences. It's beyond my comprehension. I can only put it down to ignorance and lack of education.
That's very true. And I don't, and I think just talking about what you can actually do as members of the public, I mean, you can't underestimate the public's power to actually push for change. If you look at Mulrunji, all of those protests and the public debate led to Chris Hurley eventually getting charged. So
And that's I think that's a really important point, Amy. And you know, I mentioned about the social responsibility of the media, but I think ultimately the responsibility comes down to all Australians. It comes down to Western Australians in particular, who are, after all, the people who elect these people into office. Let's not forget that. So, you know, how is it that, you know, Barnett was elected into office on the platform that he would be cutting, getting tough on unpaid fines. Let's not forget that. So, you know, how is it that a whole section of the West Australian public think that this is good policy, that this is the real crime how is this a public policy issue to begin with? And I think part of that is ignorance, and part of that is just says a lot about the state of race relations and the levels of ignorance that exist in this country.
That was UN woman and UTS academic Amanda Porter, and before that, the uncle of Yamaji woman Jalika Jew, Sean Harris. And I encourage everyone to get involved in advocacy around Ms. Jew's case, even if you can't go to a National Day of Action. Let your colleagues know, let your friends know, let your family know what's happening in this country, and we can put a bit of pressure and ensure the WA government continues to act and that truth is forthcoming for this family, and not just truth, but justice. We've been ending Let's Talk for the past couple of days, and hopefully for the next few weeks, with an excerpt from Uncle Ross Watson's River Story, which is a beautiful love letter to country, and in particular the Dawson River where he grew up. And it talks about connection to land, the intimate relationship blackfellas have to that land, the two-way connection, and the importance of continuing to care for country in a world that's just solely about commodity and profit and sees land as in solely economic terms. I do want to warn Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners that it does include the voice of a deceased person, but it's a beautiful story, and I hope you all enjoy it.
Although the lifestyle may have appeared idyllic and carefree, much thought was involved in management systems. The right to hunt and gather food was not unrestricted. Any country can support only a certain number of humans through time. Writer Brudd mentions the restricted seats available on an aeroplane as an example of excessive numbers jeopardising the safety of all. Our people learned not to overpopulate in the areas. This caused grief at certain times when the welfare of country and future generations imposed restrictions, because defiant people cannot remain in country. Before the chained Migloo was shipped here, this was enforced. My system provided the clean air and water component of birthright. Another part of birthright was good relations with neighbours, and was provided by family and clan groups. Other people were allowed to become part of country. Through the ages, different humans had become lost or displaced for various reasons. When respectful relations were established, strangers could become part of family and clan groups. When this occurred, they needed to make the same commitment to duty of care for clan and country that my blood children practice. I give humans life as their first contact with the wonders of creation. Spiritual connections become stronger when people respect the truth of that reality. This spirituality cannot be mistaken as superstition, and it requires no great leap of faithful imagining. It emerges from the tangible reality of clean air, water, land, and food. Without those physical necessities, no one can know or dream anything, spiritual or otherwise. Yes, because their lifestyle is experienced from the bounty of my resources, my people call me sacred regardless of philosophical dreams and images. The carrying out of obligations to clan and country used to provide confirmation of identity and guaranteed rights within country. Today, however, the maintenance of kinship law through family, clan, and inter-clan relationships is frustrated. Responsibilities had extended through totemic networks, including spiritual connections, and ensured plants and animals always had protection through bad times and good. Spiritually, the totem system fused humans through lifestyle with land and species as sacred lifelines to the ongoing process of creation. Although the clans exploited some places and species during certain times, the breeding places of other less plentiful things were avoided and monitored to ensure continuity of life. In this way, the interdependence of all the things of creation was understood and protected. Yes, the land was once shaped and celebrated as a big integrated garden. That's right, our clans had no need to preserve food. Fresh food abounded in my basin. The lifestyle ensured favourite foods were convenient and always fresh in season. This was evidenced by every adult knowing their exact location on country for each day and season of every year. Such were the requirements of custodial obligation and reward. So it was that the people moved around country to enjoy and manage the benefits of their garden. But that was in earlier times when only proper clanspeople lived off the resources of country. Such was the spiritual and blood-given birthright of future generations to country. Today, we notice the concept of belonging is claimed by some and disputed by others. Many of the first colonials to our continent were impressed with how our country's landscape resembled the landed estates of the wealthy in England. Life was not a struggle for the people of our country. The management system left no undergrowth or deadfall amongst the trees in more open areas. The phenomenon of soil erosion was restricted by the clan's management systems, which kept my own and most river depths shallow and clear. This allowed us to spread wild and free across our flatlands in wet times. With most of our basin lands now stripped and exposed to the elements, much less water is retained on this, the driest continent on Mother Earth. Muddy flows and deeply gouged beds are the colonial legacy in our waterways. But initially, the more astute amongst the new arrivals likened the appearance of the country to congenial parks. One colonial described a trip from Hobart to Launceston in horse and carriage without having to cut down a single tree. In every corner of our southland, these patterns of human occupation on country were observed by those with the eyes to see.